Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and you are listening to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we talk all things economy, tech, and culture. And we do that for, with, and by you.
Ooh, that's a good one. For, with, and by.
For, with, and by should be its own t-shirt. Anyway, turns out none of us is as smart as all of us.
That's true. That's true.
You.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, so we're here, but really we're kind of not here because it's still on holiday, even though it's technically not holiday. We're just kind of fudging it a little
bit.
But, you know, we'll be back. New episode next week, I promise.
And to be fair, it's not really so much of a holiday thing. It's that I am, as you are hearing this,
that's true.
Let's just have a time travel moment. Yeah, it's really my fault. I'm at CES.
All right.
I'm at CES, the giant tech extravaganza.
Consumer Electronics Show. Come on, tell people what it is.
Formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show.
Now they will send you AARP.
Stern note. Oh, really? Is AARP no longer? Yes, this is a thing, by the way.
Yeah.
This is a kind of an interesting
story. Oh, look, NPR is not really National Public Radio. It's NPR, which, by the way, we are not, but that's a whole different thing. Don't hit me on Twitter because I'm sick and tired.
Yeah, we're APM.
It doesn't matter. Nobody cares. I love you on NPR, Kai. I love NPR, too.
I also love me on NPR.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yes.
Anyway, formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show. So as you are hearing this, anything could be happening. I could be doing like a self-driving skateboard or a brain-controlled skateboard situation or trying
out
some
driverless
tech.
That would be awesome. Are you going to like plug electrodes into your head?
I did do that. I have done a mind-controlled skateboard. I've ridden that. Yep.
Wow.
I'll send you the video. It was super crazy. It turns out that it's really hard to stop. It's hard to make yourself think about stopping. Anyway, it was fascinating.
Not just like internally screaming, stop! Well,
that doesn't work. Nope. Like you have to actually picture yourself stopping. It's like this mindful moment where you have to imagine yourself stopping.
That is not useful technology. That's all I'm saying. If internally screaming stop doesn't get you to stop, then I think that's a failed product launch. I'm just saying. Anyway, so here's what we're going to do. And for all you skateboard scientists out there, go ahead, at me, whatever you want. We are going to do an oldie but a goodie. It's about something called the D School at Stanford University. Molly and I are huge fans. She's actually a bigger fan than I am because she's actually been there, right? Don't you get to go down there every now and then?
I actually haven't gotten to
go.
I keep getting these nice invitations from the person you're about to hear, and I can never go because work.
Yeah. So they do design, right? And it's everything from products to projects around the office or the home, also to policy. It's a different thought process, actually, I guess you would say, of approaching pretty much anything. And it's awesome. So we did an interview with Sarah Stein Greenberg. She runs the Stanford Design School. And we were talking about design thinking, technically, I think. And Molly got us started with really the most basic question of all. Here you go.
All right. Just tell us, for those who, people don't know, what does design thinking mean? And how is it different from designing?
Oh, yeah.
Well, great place to start. So as you walk through the world every day, just about everything around you is designed, right? Like not the natural world, which we have a lot to learn from, but every time you get in your car, every time you make that artisanal coffee in your home, every time you go to the DMV, you are in a designed experience. Some of those are great. Some of those are not so great. But somebody made that. Somebody brought that experience to life for you. And design thinking is really a set of methods and strategies and approaches that can help you improve the impact and the effectiveness of the thing that you're designing. It is really fundamentally about first understanding the needs of the people that you're designing for. It's this very human-centered, empathetic way to look at the creative process. And it also relies on a set of strategies about testing and prototyping your ideas really early.
When did design thinking separate from, and I'm making an assumption here, separate from straight up industrial design, right? Here's how a can opener has to work to get the can open. This is the industrial design for that, as opposed to however design thinkers would go about it.
Yeah, so design has really been in a constant state of evolution for the last, I don't know, 100 or so years. And I would say a big demarcation happened around the 50s and 60s. And particularly as people started to design interactions that were more than just physical products. So as machines started being something that a human would interact with on a regular basis, like a computer, or as people started to look at services as something that you could design, that's when there was a need for a more, I don't want to say universal vocabulary, but a more useful vocabulary that people in lots of different functions in industry could actually participate in.
Am I a loser if I didn't know what design thinking was? Literally until 5 years ago when a marketplace colleague went and did a fellowship up at Stanford and took courses at the D school?
I would not say you're a loser. No, Kai.
So the thrust of the question is, it seems to be a bit buzzy now, right? It's gained in popularity in the last like decade-ish.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are some really interesting reasons for that. I think that, you know, when I see students who have come to Stanford in part because they know that the D school is there, because they're going to be able to learn design thinking, I always drill down and try to understand why. And I think it's partly having to do with just the amount of complexity in the world today, the degree to which people are faced with problems that they know that they can't be perfectly trained for ahead of time. They're going to have to find answers to problems without obvious solutions over the course of their careers. And this is driven by technological change and all the kinds of social upheaval that we're seeing. And so the relevance of a methodology like design and design thinking, where you can even call out really clearly, okay, this is the process that I want to use for this particular kind of problem, I think that relevance is huge right now for folks in industry and government, et cetera.
So you're saying it's partly popular, not just because it's a good way to make a complicated system easier to use, but also because it's a method that people can apply in the real world?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that more and more people are coming up through the educational system in these fairly rigid, test-oriented environments. And then you hit the real world and you find, oh, the answer isn't in the textbook, right? The professor doesn't know the answer to the problem that I'm now trying to solve now that I work at a big tech company or that I work at, you know, in a public service role. And having strategies for being able to create really human-centered, effective, creative solutions is incredibly valuable no matter what you're going to be doing in the world.
Okay, so walk me through the intentionality, the methodology. You are presented with a problem, problem X. How do you sit and apply, or stand if you like, design thinking?
Well, I'm glad you said stand, because actually, like, just sitting behind your desk is a really key part of it.
Oh, good.
So the real fundamental idea behind design thinking is that you try to understand the world through the eyes of the people that you're designing for. And so in practice, what we do in our classes is we actually have students get out in the world. They're interviewing people. They're shadowing them. They're, you know, sitting in their homes and their couches, really trying to understand what is it that the folks who they're designing for really need in a given situation. And then they come back to the studio and they have all of this really unruly subjective data, right? Some of it's qualitative, maybe some of it's quantitative. They might be looking at broader social trends at the same time. And they're trying to make connections through this process that we call synthesis. And that's actually the point at which we have our students come up with the problem definition. So they really chart the course from there. They say, okay, this is the problem that I found that's really worth working on. And from there, they need to then generate a whole bunch of ideas. Some of them are good. Some of them are terrible. But one of the core philosophies is that you actually don't know what's a great idea and what's an okay idea until you build some kind of manifestation of them in a way that the people you're designing for can test and can experience. And then you actually iterate your idea and you improve it by going back and testing with those folks.
Because that human experience is so central to it, and you have to sort of understand the way that a human is going to react to different things and predict that, one of the things that we have brought up on this show is whether design thinking is a thing that could help predict unintended consequences of technology. Like, is that a reasonable hypothesis? That if you were Facebook and you said, okay, we're going to introduce live video, that a process of design thinking could help you see some of the terrible unintended consequences of that before it happened?
For a long time, people created things and put them in the market without any of this kind of testing. And the kind of smartest idea won in the room, and then you just put it out in the world. And I think that what design encourages is, one, that you are really looking for what the real needs are before you put something out in the world. But then you are doing this testing in a way that can help you get ahead of some of those unintended consequences. So absolutely, if you're designing a new feature for your platform or your site or your company, you should be testing that with users early and watching the behavior and seeing whether those outcomes are in line with what your goals are, maybe your corporate goals, but also perhaps your broader social goals. I will also say that I think that this is getting more challenging in the era of technologies like machine learning, like algorithm-based design, where the opportunity to get to scale much more quickly than you used to be able to get is here. And so the implications for how do you do that kind of testing, how do you get ahead of any unintended consequences, I think it just got a lot harder. And I think this is an incredibly fruitful area. And I'm starting to see interesting collaborations between folks in the data science community and the design community coming together and collaborating to try to figure out, okay, how could we start to prototype what these kinds of unintended consequences might be when we're dealing with these new technologies?
Okay, so building off that, and I'm not sure that this is really a fair game question, but if you get out of the world of corporateness and technology and applications to consumers, is there a way that design thinking applies in the land of public policy?
Well, I will tell you that we've run a bunch of experimental classes around this, and I also see governments increasingly look to design to help figure out what are the kinds of services and experiences that they should be delivering. So in terms of public services, I can give you a really concrete example if
Sure.
you'd like. We had a group of folks who had studied at the D School and then moved to Detroit, and they've been partnering with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services for the past couple of years. And one of the tasks that they were given was to look at the fact that actually there's almost $1 billion of unclaimed public benefits available each year. And when they looked at that system, they saw that one of the major barriers was that the form to apply for these benefits was 42 pages long. It had something like 18,000 words in it. It was like incomprehensible. It was really hard for people to get through. And it was taking a ton of time on the caseworker's part to actually correct all the mistakes. And so what they did was they really looked at the humans involved. They looked at the people who were trying to apply for benefits. They looked at the caseworkers. They looked at all the administrative rules and the state regulations governing this process. And it took 2 years and thousands of hours of these kinds of human-centered interviews and prototyping and testing. And what they came up with is a form that is that cut the amount of words and time that it takes by 80% and allows the caseworker to have a much richer engagement that's not just about correcting errors with the person who's applying for benefits. And the state of Michigan has actually rolled this out across the whole state. So we're seeing some traction in really large bureaucratic systems to rethink some of those fundamental services that governments offer using, you know, through this lens of human-centered design.
All right. So not to rain on the parade on the way out here, but what can design thinking not do? You know?
It can't tie your shoes. No, I mean, you probably could create a better process for design for tying your shoes.
Although, frankly, wait, let me just say, my 14-year-old has a way of tying his shoes that will blow you away. I'm going to take a video when he gets home from this trip he's on, and I'm going to put it online, and you guys will, I promise. It's the coolest thing.
Anyway, yeah, well, people are inherently creative. That's right? Awesome. Yeah, so here's what I think design thinking is not great for. I always like to tell my students that if you have an idea for the solution already, one, don't use design thinking because you're going to waste your time. And two, it's probably not going to be innovative because, you know, we often start out a process with ideas that have come before. And it's only by really working with this messy, interesting data and getting to know these people that you're designing for that you get these creative opportunities, that you kind of put yourself in the way of these creative opportunities. Hmm. So you really want to be choosing a problem to work on that is open-ended, that where you're seeing some kind of disconnect in human behavior, where you can't understand why people are doing this when you think it's so obvious that they should be doing that. Those are great problems for design, where design can really help you find new solutions.
Fascinating. Well, and so empathy often comes up as a tool, and maybe the key tool in design thinking. That's also come up a lot on our show. Is this a process that can teach empathy also? You know, like if you're not already inclined toward it and you made it part of your sort of scientific curriculum, like could you start to inculcate it in some way?
So I see our students gaining empathy every time they tackle one of these projects, you know, whether that's we're running a class on, you know, redesigning, navigating the healthcare system. And we're having students work with veterans at the Palo Alto VA who are seeking mental health care services, or whether we're sending a team of students to a cardiac care hospital in southern India and asking them to look at the experience that the families of patients are having while they're waiting in the hallways. The students are really getting pushed to get out in the world, get off campus, have these very powerful learning experiences. And when they do that, they realize that the empathy that they're gaining for the people they're designing for is this incredibly powerful ingredient. It fuels this sense of urgency for, actually, I really want to create something that's going to be positive and powerful for these people. And it brings you all kinds of creative ideas that you didn't know that you could access. And you never would have if you didn't actually get out from either behind your desk or get out of the classroom and go, you know, walk in the shoes of these folks.
Sarah Stein Greenberg from the Stanford D School, which I swear this is the year. In 2019, my new resolution is I'm going to go to the D School because I find this concept so interesting, even though Kai said he thought it sounded too hard.
Well, and so if I remember my initial reaction, this is us back to live now, by the way. If I remember my initial reaction to that interview when it first aired and when we did it, I don't have the patience for design thinking. I'm a go from the gut kind of guy, shoot from the hip kind of person.
That's very true.
And I just, I don't, you know, design schmazine. That's what I got.
It would be, I almost want us to like audit one of these classes side by side. And
oh my God, right?
See,
and just do it like a brainwave pattern analysis. I'd be like, come on, will you? And you'd be like, oh, wow, that's so interesting.
Like, oh, let's explore that's this further. Because yeah, it's right? true. One Kai Rizdahl would rather die than brainstorm.
Oh, my
Let
God.
Let me just tell you
oh
that.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Fascinating. Yeah. I wonder how she would differentiate design thinking from brainstorming and how that we should. Ah, we're going to have to call her up again. Anyway.
I was about to say, who cares? Whatever. Just anyway.
Ah, see?
Oh, my
see?
God. So moving right along before I get myself into more trouble.
There is more from Sarah yet ahead. But first, tell us what you're smart about and what you want to get more smart about in 2019. People really loved this episode and felt like they learned a lot from it. And that was the entire goal. So keep that feedback coming. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org is our email. And of course, you can tweet us. We're going to be back with more, like I said, from Sarah, plus another Design World guest after this short break.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we are back. A little bit more now from Sarah Stein Greenberg of the Stanford D School, Stanford Design School. Her answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, for those of us who have forgotten, what is something you thought you knew, but then found out you were wrong about?
I love this question. I actually bought a book on this topic because there's a great book,
there's a book
by educators. There is a book. It's called, hold on.
I love it. You're stalling. She is stalling.
Yeah. No, I'm not stalling. It's called I Used to Think and Now I Think. Based on this. You should check it out. It's pretty cool. So I have been giving this a lot of thought. So I had an incredible class in college with this professor named Paul Dawson. It was called Public Policy in America. And I wrote a paper for it. I must have been designing like some policy or making some recommendations. And I got the paper back and I got a B-, which I was uncomfortable with, let's say. And the feedback my professor, many overachieving college students today, I had not seen that letter before, really rattled me. And what Professor Dawson had written was, Sarah, you have to stop designing policy as if you think that everybody else in the world is just like you. And this planted a seed for me that I think you can kind of clearly see in the work that I do today. This idea that, you know, your own biases, your own perspectives are not the things that give you great ideas about what to do in the world. It's a combination of your own intuition and skills with a deep understanding and appreciation for the different ways that people are, the different experiences that people have had in their lives, and the different needs that they might have.
I got an F in Latin once in college.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've shared that before. Yeah. B.
I definitely don't want to talk about grades anymore with Sarah Stein Greenberg, that's for sure.
Oh, my God.
I have to say about
that. But I thought it was pretty good. I thought that was a pretty good answer.
I do. Minus it was a great answer. And I love that I'm sure that many of you have had similar experiences. There's those people that, like, people often try to impart wisdom, and once in a while it sticks. And when it sticks, it really sticks. And it's such an interesting, it's so cool to explore, like, when that was.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I'm still waiting for it. Anyway, so one more little design thing that we've got for you. I sat down, God, it's months ago now, but we're going to re-up it because it was a pretty good, interesting little segment. I sat down with designer Jonathan Adler a number of months ago, as I said. He does lamps and butter dishes and all kinds of stuff that you've seen in fancy design magazines. He has his own stores now. His name is on the door. He is, and I think he actually says this in the piece we're about to hear, an eponymous lifestyle brand, which to me is just like the height of A, ego, but B, also, you know, hey, man, you got to do it.
Own it.
So Amazon apparently, I guess, recently tapped him for its first design collaboration on stuff for your house, which I didn't know until I read it right here in this rundown that we've got in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm looking
so it up. We're going to re-up this thing from a number of months ago, Jonathan Adler, and how he got to be, I guess, who he is.
I am Jonathan Adler. I am a potter, designer, retailer, and maker. I really started out as a production potter. Thrown on clay, I would rollerblade to my studio. This is in my mid-20s. Rollerblade to my studio, get there at 7 a.m., listen to NPR all day long. And at 11 p.m., when I'd heard All Things Considered for the 17th time.
Tibetan monks provided the great peace marchers with a beat, much as they've done throughout the 9.5-month-long trek.
I was like, I got to get out of here. But somehow I managed to transition from being a really small-time cottage industry guy with a very small thinker as well, into an entrepreneur. I actually came at my business from a completely non-business-like standpoint. I think that served me really well. I was very sort of airy-fairy in my thought process, and I didn't even know what an invoice was when I started. So now I know it all, but I actually think that in an era in which people in business all strive for authenticity and come up with their authenticity mission statements before they even make something, I sort of chuckle because I came at it the exact opposite way, authentically. I am authentic. I try really hard to tune out the noise of, like, my business people who, you know, I have a teams of planners and saying we need more of this color and less of that and blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of make the stuff that I really want to make. Sometimes it's extremely eccentric. It's always very, very personal. And strangely, and perhaps happily, I find that the more outré, the more eccentric, the more personal something is, the more successful it is. So I really think if your heirs won't fight over it, we won't make it. Like, I only want to make the stuff that people will hold on to, that they will fight with their siblings over, that I want people to really remember my stuff and to make an impression. So that's something I want to achieve. I want to create fistfights between siblings in the future.
So Jonathan Adler, design guy, eponymous lifestyle brand, also, and I probably should have said this in the setup, started with clay, which I thought was kind of interesting because you got to start somewhere.
I know.
Right?
Yeah, and his looks now could not be farther away from pottery.
No, that is a fact.
I'll tell you,
fact. Also price tag wise, but that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, I looked up some of that stuff on Amazon, and it's a...
Yeah.
I'm a good IKEA. and there you go. That is our last re-spin for a bit. I promise we'll be back with new episodes. I shouldn't promise because anything can happen.
No, stuff happens. I could get hit by a bus. Come on.
I'm going to Vegas. I'm just saying.
And, well, hey, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Unless you tell it on this podcast.
So God willing, we'll be back with new episodes next week.
God willing. Anyway, so marketplace at makemesmart.org is makemesmart.org is where you can get us. Also on Twitter, at Molly Wood, at Kai Rusdahl, hit us up. And I think that's where we are. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Just back from an awesome vacation, by the way. I'm just saying that. Senior producer is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner is the digital producer. He's still on break, man. I haven't seen him in like days. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Aren't you appreciating all the updates to our staffing patterns here at Marketplace?
Exactly.
Theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Ben, also on vacation.
On vacation. Because Baby, the executive director.
That's true. Is he actually on Baby Leave?
I think so. I actually don't know. Right. Yeah. Executive Director of On Demand is Tardy Evans, and the Senior Vice President and General Manager is Deborah Clark.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.